That is to say, the only reason that anything ever happens in history is because of the dynamically interacting polarities of social construction. Originally, you had this feudal aristocracy, who, as we know, they got bumped off in the French Revolution by the bourgeoisie. You've heard about them. Some of you are them. That is, some of us are them. The middle classes, the famous rising middle classes. They've been rising so long and so high in our history textbooks, but by now they can probably be viewed only with the most powerful optical instruments. But they are out there, and they're the group that was going to overthrow and did overthrow the feudal aristocracy. But according to Marx's theory, they inevitably brought with them the instrument of their own destruction, namely the urban proletariat, that downcast working class who was actually going to do all the scut work in the great mills and factories that made bourgeois thought. Well, now, Marx's theories haven't worked out, actually, although all that well, especially in recent years. But that isn't my point. My point is that he typifies, it seems to me with absolute accuracy, this fundamental mental habit of modernity, which is to see the world organized according to dynamically interacting polarities. Now, people might have been able to accept that with equanimity and still kept something of the old world if it wasn't for our next great friend, Sigmund Freud. Because Freud comes along and says, you really ain't heard nothing yet, because you thought it was simply out there with the butterflies or in the social structure, and I am here to tell you that it is actually within you. That is, human nature, human psychology, according to Freud, is built upon the irresolutions and conflicts and competitions of vying forces at the very heart of your own being. The only reason that you are the slightest bit interesting is because you are a bundle of unresolved contradictions, most of them sexual and rather titillating in nature. Your id is constantly running away with your libido and that kind of thing. Now, the Freudian view of human beings, that is, as made up primarily of psychological aspects, and think of how we talk about people. I mean, whether we're Freudians in some sort of formal sense or not, we're constantly using these kind of categories, that so-and-so has a dependency problem, or so-and-so has hang-ups, or so-and-so has a thing about his mother. This kind of typical Freudian language speaks of these irresolutions and conflicts within human nature. The way I like to think about the modern world, it comes to me through a sort of bad film that some people of my generation may remember, Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winter's Night of the Hunter. Takes place in West Virginia, as I recall, and Robert Mitchum plays a demented Baptist preacher who goes around murdering people, specifically Shelley Winter. He has he has tattooed on the four fingers of one hand, L-O-V-E, pronounced love in these parts, and on the other hand, H-A-T-E. And at cardinal moments in the film, he holds up his hands in front of him and has a kind of interior Manichaean hand wrestle. Which side of his nature is going to win out? This was ripped off, if you noticed, in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, where the guy actually had rings that spelled out this idea. But it exemplifies in an amusing and popular way, dramatizes this idea, I think, that most of us have, that there's a great conflict within us, and that whatever results artistically, is likely to come out of this conflict in the way that the irritant grain of sand within the oyster makes the pearl. Now, when we look specifically at aesthetic questions, that is, questions that have to do with the interpretation of beauty or of meaning in works of art, particularly works of literature, there's some broad implications for the different patterns that we have as compared to the people in the old world with regard to intellectual structure. What is the purpose and nature of all art, but specifically, of course, of a work of literature? most of us would say, do you remember how the MGM lion used to growl at you at the beginning of movies? And it said around the edges, Ars gratia artis. Art for the sake of art. There is no other explanation for art. Art doesn't need to be anything. A poem should not mean, but be. This is the modern and romantic view of art. And it contrasts strongly with the idea held in previous generations that there definitely was a purpose for art. This is why, you know, so many Renaissance painters had patrons. These weren't people who just were interested in art, like some modern foundation, and said, oh, here's a good artist, here's some money, go out and do what you want to. Not at all. They were interested in aggrandizing the power and reputation of their own family. They wanted wonderful, idealized portraits made of the members of this family and so on. The church, the greatest of all patrons of art in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, didn't simply turn to artists and say, here, go out and do whatever you want. Not at all. They gave them very specific commissions that were designed to promote and propagate their spiritual and artistic agenda. We tend to think that art and artists in particular are unique. That is, that no two artists are alike and that no two works of art should be alike. I invite you to go to your local bookstore and look at the 40 or 50 novels that have been published during the last month. There they are, vying with each other, competing with each other. Pick one up and turn it over and you will see a photograph of the bearded or braided author of this work, and it will say of him and her that he or she has done all sorts of absolutely remarkable and unique things, such as they have made a papier-mâché model of the subway system of New York, they've backpacked through Afghanistan, they live with their significant other in an abandoned railway car in Soho when they are not working at their secondary job as a truck driver and so forth. And they sound like very, very interesting people. And then it goes on to describe the work that you will read in this novel. And it usually says something like this, an exciting new talent appears on the American literary scene. What it never says is another hackneyed treatment of a well-worn theme. So you can be pretty sure just on the odds of it, that not every novel that is published every day of every week and every year actually can be all that dynamically original, but we think it should be original. Well, go ask Alexander Pope in the 18th century what the purpose of art is. Is the purpose of art to be original? True wit is nature to advantage dressed. He says, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed. That's the purpose of art. What oft was thought. The purpose of the artist is not to give you new thoughts. Those thoughts have been presented already by God and people who know in the past, and we have everything pretty well sewn up in this best of all possible worlds. But the job of the artist is to write with brilliant artistic flair about what is already known. What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. Now, you know, this is not going to go over with modern poets in the Romantic tradition, one of whom said, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. We expect political statement, political commitment, original philosophical point of view from our artists, and quite often, especially in the Middle Ages, you simply are not going to find that. This is closely connected to the traditional versus the original. Must you, either as a reader or a writer, constantly be coming up with some very new thing? I used to be the chairman of my English department, and in this capacity, I was occasionally invited to cocktail parties where I hobnobbed with the literati. And I was once at a New York cocktail party where I was talking with a very attractive young woman who seemed to be taking an interest in me. That was quite an exciting thing. This conversation went pretty well until she brought up the latest John Updike novel. Now, Although I am a professional medievalist, and although I try never to read a book published after the year 1400, occasionally I do slip, and I have, in fact, read several of Updike novels, but I hadn't read the latest novel. And this obviously was going to put an end to this conversation and any tentative interest that my interlocutor might have in me. And she looked at me with pity and said, "What a shame. It's been out for 6 weeks, this novel." Now, I did not say, but I felt like saying, "Have you ever read The Consolation of Philosophy of Boethius? It's been out for 1,400 years." Because this, I think, would have been the proper sort of medieval response.